We used to worry about the US and now China polyethylene capacity waves drowning global markets. But now, could a structural change see soaring demand for polyethylene absorb all that new production? I'm Will Beacham, and also in this week's podcast, a new study suggests all plastics production could be low carbon by 2050. Plus, we catch up on European chemical markets. With me to discuss these important topics are my panel of usual guests: John Richardson, Senior Consultant in Asia for ICIS, Paul Hodges, Chairman of New Normal Consulting, and Nigel Davis, our Insight Editor. Nigel, perhaps we could start with you this week. Let's have a catch up on European chemical markets. I've just been looking at the Newswire, ICIS News, which has articles, some articles about prices retreating, supply and demand starting to normalize. That's, for example, benzene. But there, in other markets, we're still seeing tight supply, strong demand, and very high pricing. What's your feeling about European chemical markets at the moment, Nigel?
Well, I mean, I think you suggested it, Will. It's a question of supply and demand, isn't it? I mean, we've seen that, you know, the cracker supply is fairly balanced. The thing is with the aromatics is the refinery operating rates have come up a bit, and so therefore we're seeing more supply there, and clearly more supply from the crackers as well. So, you know, that market is easing a bit, and there's still pretty strong demand. You know, this is the point. There's still pretty strong demand down the multiple petrochemical chains. So, you know, we're not in a position yet where we're seeing any decline in demand. And so those prices are being underpinned by that, you know, the strong pull through from the market. And Oxford Economics was saying last week that most indicators in Europe are suggesting that a strong recovery is underway in the Eurozone, for instance. You know, leading indicators showing a strong rises in mobility and confidence across the board. So they're suggesting that we'll see a sharp economic rebound in the coming months. So we obviously there's concern about inflation down the chain, and so therefore costs rising. Obviously we're seeing crude prices rising, and so that's putting pressure on the petrochemical producers to actually maintain those relatively high prices as well in many instances. But this is early cycle sort of commodity inflation, and it'll take a while before. In past crises, it's taken years for sort of inflation to work its way down through into wage inflation, for instance. It could only take perhaps quarters now, because everything seems to be on speed, or to be speeded up now post-pandemic, or as we come out of the pandemic in Europe. Remember, we've got the sort of the vaccine rollouts are strong across large parts of Europe. We're seeing people move around more, although there's been a slight delay in the UK in the announced yesterday. But you know, the economies are really starting to gear back up, and people want to get out there and start doing things again.
And how about the supply chain disruption? We were in our news meeting this morning talking about an outbreak of coronavirus in southern China, putting pressure on the container system. And I think there are still hiccups there, aren't there? Things haven't smoothed out yet on the container system, at least.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's an ongoing problem, and I haven't seen or read of any suggestions of how that's going to ease. It's getting worse. You know, that situation is getting worse, particularly with lockdowns in parts of China to contain sort of coronavirus outbreaks, pockets of coronavirus outbreaks. So therefore, you know, I can't see the supply chain issues easing on that front for some time yet. So again, in certain markets, that sort of underpins high or relatively high prices, and you know, we can expect that to continue, as I said, for you know, weeks, if not quarters now. It's a question really of when that really does begin to ease. But I mean, the economic outlook is pretty positive.
Thank you, Nigel. Paul, you found a new study by the Nova Institute, which is a consultancy focusing on the transition of chemicals industry to renewable carbon, which was commissioned by Unilever. And that sort of shows how concerned the brand owners are about implementing circular economy in chemicals. It shows world plastics production rising to 1.2 billion tons by 2050, but models 100% of this demand being met by recycling, bio-based plastics, or other low carbon technologies. How realistic do you think this modelling is, bearing in mind the challenges and the relatively tiny volumes of plastic currently being recycled, Paul?
Well, I think you look at two elements, really, don't you? One is there market demand for recycled plastic? Because if there isn't, you're kind of wasting your time. And secondly, do you have the technology available that can meet that demand? You might say, look, there's lots and lots of demand to go into space, but we don't really have much technology available. It's a couple of rockets or something. However, I'm wildly excited about all this, I have to say, because this is a very well respected institute, the Nova Institute in Germany. They're very, very sound in what they're talking about. And the first thing they're saying is that there is clearly very strong demand for recycled plastic in this area. And that's not just about the waste plastic issue, which we've talked about in the past. This is a more fundamental issue relating to carbon and climate change and COP26. Because what they say, and I haven't seen this before, this is why I think it's such an important sort of study. Contrary to energy, it is not possible to decarbonize chemicals and products. The renewable carbon family is the only pathway to a sustainable future for commonly used materials such as plastics, fibers, surfactants, and other materials based on organic chemicals and the industries that produce them. I mean, that is the equivalent moment to, as we've talked about in the past, the 1960s, where the visionary industry leadership at the time said, look, we're not going to bother anymore with coal. We're going to move at cost, obviously, it's going to cost us money and everything else, over to oil and gas, which set the framework for the massive expansion we've seen in the last 50 years. And what they're saying now is, we know that you can replace fossil fuels. The International Energy Agency has already said, you don't need to do any more investment in fossil fuels. It's over. You know, people may want to continue to do things and so on. It doesn't matter. The world has moved on. And here you have Unilever, one of the big packaging consumers. But look at the Ellen MacArthur Foundation website. You know, you've got over 400 major companies and governments going down this direction. And you're going to get more with COP26. And it secures the future of the chemical industry. Then the second point, the technology. Well, it's pyrolysis, chemical recycling. You know, we've been doing pyrolysis for 60 years. You know, I agree that we haven't done pyrolysis on a local scale, a city scale. Fine, we've got to trial that and so on. But that's, you know, nobody is suggesting, as far as I know, that is going to prove a problem. It's just we need to fine tune the whole thing, and we need to get collection right and so on. So we've got a vast market there, and a vast market not just around consumers who are worried about waste plastic, but policymakers who are worried about climate change. That's, you know, and companies like that. So I'm just wildly enthusiastic, and the fact that it is the Nova Institute who are, you know, so respected in this area, and they're doing it for Unilever, is fantastic.
Is it realistic to think that a technology like pyrolysis could really solve all these problems? I mean, it's
all you have to do is to say, look, let's use an analogy here. The car industry has made the same thing. It's 3 to 4 years ahead of us, and it said, you know, 2017 in Europe, 2015 or so in China, for pollution reasons, Dieselgate and so on, we have to move to EVs. And what they've done is they've used the cash and the profit from traditional diesel and gasoline cars to fund the development of EVs and autonomous vehicles. Well, we can do the same thing. We can use the cash flow and the profit from traditional virgin plastics at the moment to fund the development. You know, we're making vast amounts of money as an industry at the moment, which is great. And we've now got a really good investment opportunity to, you know, let's put the money that we're making today into securing and growing the future. I mean, the numbers that that Nova are talking about are really very large. You know, we're talking about, at the moment, we use 67 million tons of renewable carbon, which is great. So we keep 67 million tons of carbon out of the atmosphere. That's a really positive achievement. And they expect that it will, that we will, because of the expansion here, we will be reaching, keeping 1,000 million tons of carbon out of the atmosphere. So we're making a fantastic social contribution. We're supplying products that need and that improve their daily lives, and we're going to be able to make money for it. And as I say, the funding is there at the moment because everybody's making money. You know, it's not as if we're at the bottom of the trough and people are scratching around to pay wages. The money is there to fund the development, just as it is with the car industry. You know, people are buying gasoline and diesel cars, as Nigel was saying just now. So you've got the ability to fund what you're doing. It's a really good future.
Thank you, Paul. Nigel, I'd like to get your view on that. What kind of role do you think recycling technologies, chemical recycling, mechanical and so on, can play in solving sustainability challenges facing the chemical sector?
Well, as you know, Will, in Europe, I mean, the debate is still out as regards chemical recycling, which is an umbrella term, remember, for lots of different types of processes or different processes. But and it challenges mechanical recycling because the mechanical recycling side of things works pretty well for various products in Europe at the moment. It gives you a relatively clean product. You know what you're getting. Chemical recycling clearly is another dimension to the recycling debate, if you want to call it that, or to circularity. But remember, you know, the EU and other nations in Europe are signed up to sort of certain circularity targets, and they're certainly signed up to their carbon targets as well. And to make this work, you know, as the chemical industry keeps saying, we've got to sort of debate and actually allow some forms of chemical recycling. And FEICHE, which is the Spanish Trade Association for the Chemical Industry, was saying that Spain's recycling rates, for instance, could go from 45% now to be 80 to 90% by 2050 if chemically recycled materials are granted status as a recycled product. And that was FEICHE's president talking in an interview with ICIS last week. So, you know, the opportunities are there. And I mean, companies realize that the opportunities are there. The chemical producers want to get involved. And of course, you've got the brand owners as well, down into the, you know, the products that you and I buy in the local market, local supermarkets. They want to be part of this. They clearly need to be part of it and developing new types of packaging that is not multi-layer, that is more easily recyclable or more easily recycled. And consumers are looking for that, the same thing, whether it's textiles, whether it's a clothes shop you go to, a fashion house or somewhere like that, or whether it's just to your local supermarket. So in some respects, I agree with Paul that everything is working together in this regard and pushing to actually enable further recycling and much, much higher rates of recycling, which I think we will see relatively quickly.
Thank you, Nigel. John, I'll give you the recycling question at the end, but you've been doing some modelling using the supply and demand database on polyethylene, which suggests that booming demand could absorb this massive ramp up in US and China polyethylene capacities that we're seeing at the moment. Before the pandemic, we were all very concerned about massive overcapacity leading to collapsing margins and plant closures. So what's changed?
Well, it's probably the tone of the, you know, previous comments. Well, is this good news or bad news? Depends whether we can meet the demand sustainably, which is the core challenge of the industry. But I think what we've seen is, you know, increased hygiene needs, people not as concerned about the plastic waste they're creating for face masks and for, you know, HDP gloves and hand sanitizer bottles. And that's locked in. You know, I mean, we're not going to change those precautionary hygiene habits for many years, even if we get on top of things in developed markets. And it really is developed markets plus China, which is more than 70% of demand. Developing world is different. Developing world is just weaker, full stop, for everything, because of people falling back into extreme poverty and less people escaping extreme poverty in the first place. But in the developed world, in China, you know, these secular shifts in demand, the thing about internet sales is huge. The $14 billion going into, you know, food delivery startup companies, it comes with a lot of packaging. And we're seeing that in China. We've seen that in China for many years now, where it's divorced from GDP, that, you know, the economy can go down and polyethylene demand can still be really strong. Not go down, but slows down a bit. Growth has been really good in China. And also with self-sufficiency in China, that's just a key part of the picture. You can play around with the database, our database. You can't really come to a scenario where China significantly increases its self-sufficiency in polyethylene. It's vastly different in polypropylene. Well, that's different. Demand in polypropylene is strong, but the issue there is increasing China's self-sufficiency to the point where they don't have to import. So it looks like, you know, it will be a strong period for demand over the next few years. It's baked, these patterns are baked into demand. But I think the key issue is how the industry treats this in terms of sustainability.
Well, anyone listening to this podcast in the last few weeks will know that you and Paul have got very different views on the role that recycling can play in solving the sustainability challenge. So what do you think needs to change to make recycling work, and what other approaches could be taken to meet that sustainability challenge, John?
I think broader on sustainability, I mean, clearly the Shell and ExxonMobil, you know, developments over the last few weeks are key on carbon. And you will see that the IOC is increasingly pushing towards greater carbon efficiency, you know, and reducing carbon in the petchem refinery complexes, which is terrific news. But what concerns me, the IEA report that Nigel wrote about last week, we're seeing evidence, and I suspect that this would be the case, because of what's happening with the pandemic, the developing world is struggling to hit its carbon targets. It's the last thing on their mind at the moment as they cope with this huge hole in their economies. The G7 meeting was depressing, that they only offered 1 billion vaccines, where 11 billion doses are needed. Beyond that as well, the issue of financing costs widening between the developed and developing world because of the pandemic, because of the pace of vaccines, means it's become more expensive to gain financing in the developing world. All the infrastructure issues. So really, I mean, Paul and I are both in agreement that we have to deal with this climate challenge. But what concerns me, unless the developing world gets the funding it needs, it won't be able to deal with it. I think the issue of plastic waste is a separate issue, or connected issue. Again, it's a connected issue because absolutely chemicals recycling, mechanical recycling, and the chemicals recycling offers huge promise. But it's one of a package of solutions that we need. It's not the only solution. And it comes back again to how we fund proper waste collection systems for those 3 billion people. That is absolutely essential. That needs to come from some kind of global fund to pay for that. We need to make more progress on the fact that people don't know what to do with it. Well, they've got no alternative but to leave plastic in the open environment. And then, of course, you need to change people's attitudes. Once you provide them with rubbish collection systems and processing systems, including chemical recycling plants, you've got to teach them how to use those systems. So it's a massive challenge, which I think the polymer industry needs to address. I think we need to talk about waste as an issue. The problem is not the products themselves. Products themselves deliver a lot of societal value. It's how we produce them, both in terms of carbon intensity and in terms of how they're thrown away, how they're disposed of. Those are the two issues we need to focus on. But I think in the developing world is where the demand growth will be over the next 20 years. It's tremendous demand growth in the developing world as people rise out of poverty. So we have to address these issues of, you know, equal access to technology, and dealing with the plastic on around carbon and dealing with the plastic waste issue in the developing world. I think it's essential.
Thank you very much, John, Paul and Nigel. It's very easy to listen to or subscribe to our podcasts. Now you just go to any podcast app and search on ICIS Chemical Podcasts.